Good evening. This is Sarah Robinson, host of Conscious Creating. I'd like to welcome our listeners as we continue conversations on the relationship between art and transformation. Tonight I'm joined by Betsy Chaffee, whose work as actor, producer, director, and screenwriter has led her to a place of profound personal transformation. Her latest films, What the Bleep Do We Know, and Down the Rabbit Hole, on which she worked as co-director, producer, and writer, are considered by many to be vehicles for societal transformation. Welcome, Betsy.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been said that you were literally born to be in film and television, Betsy.
Yeah.
Literally?
Literally. My birth was filmed for a show on natural childbirth.
Wow.
And I'm the youngest of six children. And it was really funny because they did not follow my mom through her whole pregnancy. They actually followed another woman who ultimately ended up having a C-section.
And so you were the stand-in baby Jesus.
I was the stand-in baby. So what happened is I was born in Anaheim, and women weren't really in private rooms, or at least my mom wasn't. There was lots of women around, and there was a kind of a labor area. And they went into the labor area, and they said, you know, does anybody here mind if we film their birth? And my mom was like, you know, I've done this six times. I'm kind of an expert. I'll do it.
That's a scream.
So, and it was really funny because my mom told me that she had, and she saved it. You know how they have those things if your child is born today?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, in the newspaper. So mine said that if your child is born today, he or she will either go into science or into entertainment.
Oh, my gosh.
So there you go.
There it is.
Here I am.
So then you worked as an actor until you were 18. How did you get into the business? I'm curious.
It was totally accidental. I was a born performer. My father was a musician, among other things, but he was, you know, really into music, and so he always used to say he and his wife gave birth to a musical band. And so we weren't really like the Partridge Family, but we all played instruments, and we all, you know, danced or did something.
You played violin, right?
I played violin, and I twirled baton, and I was marching in a parade. And an agent came up and said, gee, your little girl is really cute. Does she want to be in commercials? And my mom looked at me and said, I think I was seven at that point. And she said, I don't know, do you want to be in commercials? And I said, sure. And so that was the beginning of that. And I was teeny tiny. I was a tiny baby. And so I was a tiny little girl. And so what was great was even though I was older, I could, in the entertainment business, the older you are, if you look younger, it's great because you can work longer hours. So I did about 120 national commercials, and I did a lot of theater. I did Sound and Music and Annie and all those plays, and I played classical violin and really did a lot of that till I was about 17, and then I hit sort of this rebellious phase of my life. And I think really what happened is that I had achieved a lot of success by the time I was 17. And I really didn't screw around very much. I really didn't just, you know, do anything. You know, I just didn't. It's not like I think that I missed a childhood, because I don't. I had a great childhood. I love my parents. I'm sure there were ups and downs, but ultimately I really have a lot of respect for the way my parents raised me. And but I just kind of got rebellious. So about 17, I sort of quit everything. And kind of was lost for a couple of years, and then ended up, a really good friend of mine owned a nail salon, but she was also a makeup artist in movies, and she was doing a movie, and
she said, a stylist, or?
Yeah, she was a makeup artist,
right.
But she owned a hair and nail salon as well. And she said, you know, gosh, we're doing this movie, and you want to come and work on the movie? And I said, yeah, okay, I'll do that. You know, I don't know what that's about. And it was this terribly low-budget, horrible B, you know, action chick, like, you know, sexy movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just awful in every respect. But it was great.
Nobody was getting paid.
Oh, no. I mean, I think I made $80 a week.
Yeah.
And I went down there, and I started working as a PA, a production assistant, and getting coffee and being a slave.
And just to let the listeners know, a PA is like the lowest organism on the food chain on a film set.
Basically, like, you know, I was sweeping up the, you know, the horse poop. We were filming in this area where it was a paintball game place, and we were filming there, and my job was to go in and clean up all the paintball balls before we got there so that nobody else would step on them, but of course I stepped on all of them.
Charming.
Yeah, so it was really an interesting experience, but you know, I was humbled, and I really just kind of thought it was really, I understood a lot about the film business because I was raised in it, and I think I had always had this dream. When I was 12 years old, I did tell my parents that I was going to own my own film production company and be a filmmaker.
But
I kind of had that dream. So at that time,
you had done commercials, but had you done any feature films?
No, I hadn't done any feature films, but I had done television. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of knew that's what I wanted to do, and I kind of got lost from about 16 to almost 18. And that's why this girl, she was a friend of my mom's, kind of reminded me, hey, this is what you wanted to do, so come and do it. And on that movie, I totaled my car in the first week of filming. And so the producer, who was in the car when I totaled it, felt so bad because it wasn't my fault that the car got totaled. Somebody hit us. Said, well, I'm going to promote you to production coordinator because a production coordinator doesn't need a car. You can just sit in the office and do that stuff. And so that was really the beginning for me of working on the other side of the camera.
That's amazing.
And yeah, it was, you know, and then what happened is I started working on this movie and that movie and really kind of, you know, working my way up through the ranks. And I was really dedicated and really worked hard and got really focused on what I wanted.
When do you think you realized that that's what you wanted? I mean, you told your parents that at 12, but do you think you really knew that you wanted to be a producer? Because that, I mean, that's a big job
for a little girl,
especially.
Yeah. Well, I had, you know, I was very precocious.
Mm-hmm.
And probably, you know, I have lots of older brothers and sisters, and so I always wanted to be older. And
were you, babied?
I don't think that I was babied, but I was also, you know, I had four older brothers. So I was also the human football on more than one occasion. So, you know, I was not necessarily
a Catholic family. Or?
Oh, yeah, a good big Catholic family.
You know,
although my mother, the funny thing about my parents, which is so interesting, I look at them now and I just thought, God, what an interesting combination. My dad was going to be a priest, and my mother married him, and so she was always, his family always hated her because she took my father from the priesthood.
Wow.
But my mom was really a liberated woman. She was a teacher, and she was spiritual and religious, but somewhere along the line, all my older brothers and sisters went to Catholic school.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I was getting ready to go to school, my mother had pulled everybody out of Catholic school and pulled everybody out of the Catholic church because she really did not – she had four boys and then she had two girls. And she just did not appreciate the way girls were treated and women were treated.
And this was in the 70s, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so she basically said, you know what? I'm not going to do this. And then somewhere along the line – my dad was really into music, and he was a really spiritual person, but it was interesting because he sort of lost his attachment to the Catholic Church, but he did not lose his attachment to going to church. So we would go to a different church every weekend.
I read that.
Yeah, we would go
looking for music, or what were you, looking for?
I think that my dad, we would have talks about this stuff, but my dad really believed in the idea of unity and interconnection. I don't think he expressed it the way I express it now.
Yes.
But I think it was just within him that, you know, my father was the most open, loving. I mean, he loved everybody.
Aww.
And he was so non-judgmental, and he was so caring, and he would give everything that he had to. If you walked up to him and you had nothing, he would give you everything. He was just that way, and he just really had this love for people and this love for feeling connected, and I think he got that feeling from going into different churches.
Fascinating.
And towards the end of his life, they lived in New Orleans because my father, when all the kids were grown, and they were living in California, and he decided he went to New Orleans because it was so cute. My mom and dad would go out And we would go with them. We would visit them. I'd go bar hopping with my dad, and he'd sit there with a Coke and listen to the jazz musicians or the musicians play. And he didn't care. I mean, he would go to a rock concert.
But they actually moved classical to New Orleans. Did they do that with his work, or did they just
He kind of did it with his work, but mostly he just did it because I think he had friends there, and he really just liked the scene. He liked the experience of the music and the people. And so towards the end of his life, I mean, he would go to, when I went to visit him, we would go to a Southern Baptist church, or we'd go to a church in the middle of the bayou.
I know New Orleans well. Yeah.
All those kinds of funky places, and he did a lot of stuff for the Salvation Army. My dad would ring bells for the Salvation Army.
Oh, wow.
I mean, he just was that kind of guy, and I think he really just, it was funny, I remember a conversation with him when I was like 13 or 14. We had gone to some church, and I looked at him, and I said, you know, what I don't understand is why are there all these different churches? Why is there a Seventh-day Adventist and a Catholic and a Mormon and a Methodist and a Christian and a Lutheran? And because they all really say the same thing. Don't you think it'd be smarter if everyone just kind of got together and went to the same place? And it was just a really interesting moment with my father because he looked at me and he goes, well, if you can remember that for the rest of your life, you'll be fine.
Wow.
And that was it for him and for me. That was a really... And it's interesting because I kind of chalked that away somewhere in my brain and went about my teenage years. And
well,
here I am again, you know?
And there you are.
Yeah.
And it all comes around. When I read this about your dad and about you going to different churches, I have to share with you that I attended a Methodist church where my grandparents had been married, and the Bible that they used every week, the big thick Bible, was given, you know, by my grandparents, and it was this very formal place, and I felt a lot of love there. But we would go there, I think, to the 9 o'clock service, and then my father, who had lived away from our hometown in Chattanooga, Tennessee, for 30 years in New York and New Orleans, various places, would take us to the Unitarian Universalist Church at 11 o'clock so that we could learn about indigenous cultures and, you know, sort of a different perspective. He had been an ethical culturalist in New York. And I thought it was the weirdest thing when I was growing up. I mean, I just felt that there was this huge split.
Yeah.
But now, like you, I can really... And my father, like your father, was very kind, loving. I think really got that there was some kind of unity to all of truth, and that we didn't need to compartmentalize, but that was just culturally the way he was raised. And anyway, so coming full circle in his daughter... I'm weirder than he is, or was.
Well,
I'm an Episcopalian, but I'm an Episcopalist, and I'm a, you know, whatever. And,
well, I think it's, I'm really pleased that I was able to get that kind of upbringing, because I didn't have that, rigidity, or this is sort of like, this is the right way.
Dogma, maybe.
Yeah, this is the right way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my parents... You know, we're really passionate about dreaming and dreaming really big, which is why I think, you know, when I said to them when I was 12, you know, I want to be a filmmaker, that they were like, let's go do that. You know, my parents never really, you know, said to any of us, at least I don't recall them saying to any of the kids, you know, you have to be this, you have to do that, you have to go here, you have to go to, I mean, my father was a college professor. But, you know.
What did he teach?
He taught gerontology, sociology, and economics. I know it's very strange, but
it's strange.
it's what he did, which was really interesting, was what his examination was the study of aging, how that affected economics, and how that affected learning, and how older people adapt to the ever-changing technology of society. And he created a lot of programs, especially for foreign countries, on how to educate adults in the world of computers and how to get them up to speed so that they could, you know, compete in the marketplace. So there was a lot of countries, if you think about like China and Russia, where there was, you know, there was this, it's not like in the U.S. where computers became popular and really people of all ages had exposure to them. there were places in the world where, you know, you could be 35 or 40 and never have touched a computer or never have read a book. But because, you know, farming is changing and the world is changing, if you're going to survive, you have to learn how to do these things. So countries needed to develop, like China and Russia, needed to develop programs to teach people who probably never read a book in their life how to read.
So your father was a priest.
Huh?
Your father was a priest.
Well, basically, in his own way.
He really was in his own way. And he was also, it sounds like, living his message to you. Remember, there's just one
right.
Truth, you know.
Right.
Wow. It sounds like he was a really loving man.
He was.
How long is he?
He's been
gone.
19. Let's see. I think it was 6 years ago.
Oh.
6 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And
before your daughter was born.
Yeah, which is so unfortunate. But in one respect, it's unfortunate. But I see so much of him and her. I mean, she's so funny. She loves music. My mother tells me that I married my father because my husband is exactly like my dad.
Wow.
He's a healer. He's a chiropractor. And there's all this great, my mother always calls it voodoo healing, but she loves it. But he's also really into music and really into exposing, you know, we listen to everything. From when my daughter was born, I was like, you must only play classical music, right? And I, you know, was all into that whole, this is what inspires her brain because this is what some book had told me somewhere. And one day, you know, I would wear my daughter around the house as much as I could because she was a big girl. She would get heavy.
Yeah.
But one day my husband said, hey, let me take Ella. And she was fussing and cranky and she wouldn't go to sleep. And I tried all the, you know, the magic things that I knew. And he goes, I'll take her. You go, just relax. I think I was sort of at the place where I was like, okay, I'm going to lose it, you know.
Yeah.
He said, I'll take her. And I said, I'm going to take her to the studio. You go to lay down and have a nap. And I said, okay, I'm not going to argue with that. And I come into the studio like an hour later, and he's blasting like Led Zeppelin. And like playing drums, because he had his own studio with drums. And Alora Thea is in the little wary thing on the front of him, passed out, cold, sleeping.
Is that a hoot or what?
It was so funny because here I had all these preconceived notions about what I must do. And then I remember, it was like my dad played every kind of music. When I was like 7 or 8 and I'd been playing classical violin, I saw Louise Mandrell. Mm-hmm. I did the Barbara Mandrell show when I was a little girl. And Louise Mandrell had an electric hookup on her violin. And so I just thought that was the coolest thing. So my dad takes me out and gets an electric hookup for my violin, you know, and lets me play like The Devil Went to Georgia and all these, like, you know, rock violin songs. And I thought, God, that's so funny. And to this day, Alora Thea loves any kind of music. She just loves to put any, we play music all the time. And it's just, it's interesting how I look at her and she's singing. She loves to sing. She pulls the microphone out and sings all the time. And she knows all the words to Willie Nelson's On the Road Again.
Oh my God!
Which is
true. I used to do that with my girls, and
yeah,
in the back, always in the cars to avoid any kind of crying or negativity.
Right.
You know, yeah, I miss that. They're older now, so maybe just keep it up.
Yeah,
well, and they'll think you're weird at some point. They won't.
I told Gordy, my husband's name is Gordy, and I told him at one point. I said, you know what, Gordy, there's going to come a time when Alora Thea is going to tell you that you can't play in her band anymore.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
true. Best way.
Because I'll be the manager, and I'm going to say, Gordy,
no.
She's just going to want to be able to do her own thing. It's so funny. I just can't imagine that time, because now every night before we go to bed, we have band practice, and Alora Thea goes down, and she either plays the drums, or she plays the guitar, or she dances, and we play the instruments, and she has to dance or do her thing, and I see that. That is definitely the spirit. I wouldn't say that my father's been reincarnated in her, but I would definitely say that I see that love of life and music and expression spirit in her for sure.
Maybe it makes the loss less difficult.
Yeah.
If you've just joined us on Conscious Creating with Sarah Robinson, I'm talking with filmmaker Betsy Chassey, co-director and writer of What the Bleep Do We Know? So you worked as a VA on this low, low, low budget action picture and kind of worked your way up through the ranks. And then in 1996, you started your own production company. Right. Ramp.
Actually, that was it. I actually started that company in
1992.
That's
wrong information. Sorry.
That's okay. It probably somewhere says 1996, but I started it.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. It's Rampant.
You've got to say the name.
Rampant Feline Film.
And I love that. And how in the heck did you come up with that?
You know, a friend of mine gave me these earrings that were from the museum store that were these rampant felines, they were called, and they were from, I guess, the Inca period.
Do you know I've seen those?
Yeah.
I shop at the museum store all the time.
Yeah.
I love their jewelry.
That's the rampant feline. So when I was going to name my company, I decided I would name it Rampant Feline.
Oh.
And I started this company, and I did what most people would think is the unthinkable. I worked for Playboy. which, you know, I actually gained a lot of knowledge about the process of making movies and making videos and doing things through work. And Playboy was incredibly supportive to women producers. And I worked long
like
hard.
An oxymoron to me.
Well, you know, I mean, I have been exposed to that whole side of the world, and I have my own opinions being a woman and then being on the other side of that. And you know, my feeling is that most of the girls that I interacted with were clear in their choices
mm-hmm.
and chose that direction, and they were perfectly happy with it. And
okay.
So I didn't necessarily end up seeing people who were forced into anything. So, you know, and what I did at Playboy was, you know, very basic, silly. I didn't do anything. Mostly it was just Playmate of the Year TV special, or they had little TV shows and very, very basic, silly things. But it was great. It was a great learning ground for me as far as gaining knowledge about my field, my craft. And it helped a lot because I went on from there to be senior vice president of a company called Prosperity Pictures,
right,
which was basically an independent production company. And, you know, we didn't make any great movies. All the movies we made pretty much ended up on Showtime or HBO or Cinemax late night. You know, it wasn't anything that really was something that was going to do good for the world. But at that point in my life, you know, here I am. I'm 26 years old. I'm senior vice president of a pretty...
I was going to say, 20 in your mid-20s. And I've heard of Prosperity Pictures, and you... I mean, you worked with some big Hollywood names.
Yeah, I
did. Mary Tyler Moore, Jason Alexander, Kathleen
yep.
Turner. And the question that bubbled up for me was, how did it affect you at such a young age to work with this kind of talent? Now, I know you weren't a starstruck youth because you've been in the business and that kind of thing, but what was it like?
Well, I think for me, I really developed in my 20s the side of me that was all business.
Mm-hmm.
I was very focused on a career.
Were you kind?
Oh, sometimes.
Yeah.
But you know, I was
B-I-T-C-H when you needed to be.
Oh, I needed, yeah. I mean, you have to realize at that point, I was in charge of the money.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in charge of the money, nobody really likes you very much.
I know.
Especially because, you know, we talk about, you know, art. We're here talking about art. But the interesting thing about entertainment is also commerce. And it's very difficult to combine art and commerce in a way that sort of makes everybody happy. And I was also really young, and I was very stubborn and really probably grouchy a lot. Because I was responsible. I mean, Prosperity Pictures, I managed approximately $30 million of other people's money. And so that's a big responsibility, you know, when you're the one signing the checks, you're 26 years old, you have a bond company watching everything you do, an insurance company that basically protects the money for the investor. And it's a very serious job, and I think I was a very serious person.
Mm-hmm.
And
were you good at what you did?
I think I was very good. I delivered all of my movies on budget and on schedule, and I really developed that side, which is the business side. I really learned a lot about the business of making movies.
So did you consider yourself still an artist at that time?
No, I did not consider myself an artist.
You were more of a businesswoman.
I was a businesswoman, because that's what I wanted. I mean, if I look back, from what I understand now, it's very clear I was very focused on being successful.
Mm-hmm.
So I drove the BMW, I lived in the cute little apartment, I had the cute little clothes, I, you know, all those things. I mean, you can ask any boyfriend that I had at that time period. I actually was married for 18 months, you know, and my marriage basically broke up because of my desire to be successful on my own terms.
Oh, I relate so much to all that.
Yeah, it's
there's a cost that we, a real cost to that kind of drive and ambition.
Yeah.
And then we can get caught up so easily in
right.
something that doesn't even feel authentic. Ultimately.
You know, and you don't even realize.
You don't realize it.
Yeah. You don't realize that it's not authentic because, I mean, when we talk about the idea of the belief of creating our reality and the idea that, you know, we're magnets and we bring to ourselves that which we desire.
Right.
It's, I mean, I can look at that period of my life and see exactly why I created what I created, because I had a very clear focus about what it was that I wanted. I wanted to be successful.
Do we know different, though? I mean, I'm not sure
yeah.
we know any different, because
no.
society says success is.
Exactly.
We want to be successful as,
right.
as artists, and I'm a lot like you. I've always combined the business with the creative, and I think the people who are the most successful in the entertainment business do that, even actors.
Right.
They have a savvy marketing mind as well.
Right.
But then there's a time when some of us just hit the wall with that. And you call it, you know, your shoe consciousness.
Yeah.
Kate, tell us about that.
Well, what happened to me is I call it happily living in my shoe consciousness, which is what kind of shoes do I have?
I love
and
that.
I had some great shoes.
Did you?
And what kind of car I was driving.
What's your favorite shoes? I have to ask you that.
Oh,
Prada, or what did you like?
Well, it's those days, you know, I was really into, I can never even say it, like Mono Blalix or whatever they are. I can never say that name, but I loved those, and I just didn't care. It didn't have to be name brand shoes. I just had to have them.
Had to have them.
I was just a shoe fanatic, and to be honest with you, I have a lot of shoes now.
Yeah, see, I do too. And I was thinking we'd talk about that, you know.
Yeah,
like, you can still love the shoes, but you
exactly.
don't have to have, I mean, what's the most you ever had? Let's just tell each other.
Probably like 200 pairs of shoes.
Okay, well, I had that many, too. And this is when I was working as an actress. I'd have the heels for the,
you know,
and parties and whatever.
But and whenever you're going to go anywhere.
How many do you think you have now?
Oh, I think probably like 30, 40.
Yeah, that's me. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's still a lot of shoes.
Yeah.
And you'd still buy, like I have some green, bright green ones, and I have, you know, lots of red, tons of black. How many pairs of black shoes does
Oh, I have a lot of black. But see, the funny thing is now I live in the country, and I have all these great shoes, and I almost never wear them.
I know, me too.
My daughter wears them now.
She clumps around in them.
She clumps around. I said, well, at least they're good for something.
Yeah.
And you had to buy, if you were going to go anywhere, you had to buy a new pair of shoes, even though you might have had a pair in your closet.
Yeah, and you're 5 foot two, and you're probably thin, but my weight would fluctuate a little bit in between.
So would
years,
I.
You know, like I put on 5 or 10. You can always go buy shoes.
Yeah.
You know, when you're fat.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm sorry. I've never discussed this kind of thing on the show, but, you know, this is the way we are in the beginning sometimes.
Well, I think that me and having my stuff was my loving myself.
Yeah.
That was the way I loved myself.
Yeah.
I loved myself because I drove a convertible BMW. I loved myself because I could go out and buy shoes whenever I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And I could spend money like nobody's business.
Mm-hmm.
I was great at just spending money. I would just go out, and I would travel. I would go to Paris. I would go this way. I would go that way. I flew first class everywhere I went. I was a princess.
And you already had some money from your
job.
Work, too.
Yeah.
You were a girl, right?
And I woke up one morning, and I had this boyfriend that I had been dating for, like, 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was madly in love with this guy who was struggling a lot in his own life. I always picked up the struggler, the guy that needed a mommy to take care of him and to boss him around and to drag him around. And that was exactly what I did. I picked up, and he was great. He's a wonderful person now, and I'm friends with him now. But he was really struggling with depression and a lot of things in his life. And I woke up one morning, and I said, you know, I'm really unhappy with what I'm doing. I don't want to do this anymore. I'm going to start my own company. I don't want to work in the movie business anymore. I'm sick of making these movies. I hate every movie that I make. They're stupid. I'm tired of working with actors who, you know, are all they care about is what's in their trailer. And, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. So I went in that very morning and I quit my job. And everybody thought that I had gone completely insane. And all of a sudden, I pretty much lost all of my friends because I was sort of a nexus point.
Because you weren't cool anymore.
Well, yeah, I wasn't cool. I didn't have the cool job, and I couldn't get any of my friends' jobs. Because, see, when you're senior vice president of production, you can hire whoever you want for whatever movie you want. So I had all these friends who were really my friends because I was getting them all jobs all the time. So you got to be nice to me because I'm really getting them a job.
Oh, yeah.
But I started this company making gourmet dog treats.
That's great.
I mean, don't you do that in your life? Didn't you at some point in your life just pull some random thing out of the air and just say, I'm going to do this.
I did. And you know what did it for me? And you, it's so similar. I was on, and I'm not, wasn't as powerful or famous as you were, but I was working. You know, to be a working actor in the business for 20 years is a big deal, okay?
Yeah, exactly.
So, and in a tertiary market in Houston, Texas. But I was
working
on this film, and I shouldn't say the name because then you would know who the star was, and that would be indiscreet. But I was a day player, and there's this big star who really doesn't have a whole lot of talent. And we were getting ready, prepping up for a scene, and he just reached up and snapped his fingers. And someone came out of the wings to light his cigarette. And apparently that had been in his contract to have someone to light his cigarette.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
And I had been reading a lot and doing a lot of thinking and meditating and yoga and some different things and going in a new direction. And I just thought, there's something wrong with this picture.
Mm-hmm.
That there's
mm-hmm.
something wrong with the fact that anyone can do that, can get
right.
that in their contract.
Right.
And we all sort of laughed about it. But then later it was a catalyst for me, and it moved me to the
right.
point where I did. I quit. I walked away. Sir Peter Hall, you know, had dinner with him right across the table talking about a new show, and I walked away.
Yeah.
And I just said, you know, we're moving. and then you reinvent, and you do something
right.
else. Now, I didn't make gourmet dog treats, but I started writing in my
studies.
Well,
there you go. I mean,
you went...
I just went in some direction. I had a dog. His name was Zach. Zach was the longest-lasting man of my life.
Mm-hmm. What kind of dog?
He was like a lab Irish setter, mm-hmm. total mutt dog.
Mutt.
He passed a couple years ago, but he lived a long 15 years and was a really happy dog. But
mm-hmm.
I used to cook him dog treats,
mm-hmm.
and so I thought, I'm gonna sell these dog treats. So and I thought. I also started this business because I thought it would be something that me and my boyfriend could do together. Because he didn't have a career. He had no direction in his life. So we started this company.
Oh, great.
And within six months, we were in 400 stores across the country.
Oh, my goodness.
And we were doing really well. And I thought, all right, everything is rock. This is, see, I can do this on my own. I don't need to have the studio gig or whatever. And then what happened is that I got to a point with my company where I either had to get an investor, because when you manufacture a product like dog treats, you really, manufacturing is where it's all at. And if you want to really make the money and make it successful, you have to manufacture yourself. And at that point in time, I was going through another bakery, and it was really hard because quality control was difficult. So I needed to get like $300,000 or $400,000 to buy my own factory. And so I was working with this investor. And it's so funny because on the same day, this all three things happened at once. One was basically that the whole start, beginning of the crash of the dot-com bubble in the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
My investor, who was a wonderful Buddhist man, this is nothing, I'm not disparaging the Buddhists, but I'm just saying this, he was a Buddhist guy, and it turned out that he had decided he didn't want to have the current wife that he had anymore, who he'd brought back from India, who he'd married to for 20 years. So he was literally shipping her back to India and picking up another young 17-year-old wife. And he thought that she was sort of this dumb girl that didn't even speak the language. Well, she was actually incredibly smart and froze all of his assets. And so he could no longer invest in my company. And then within that same day, I came home, and my boyfriend's bag had fallen over off the chair. Probably her cat had knocked it over. And there was a letter from a girl that he had been dating the entire time that he was dating me.
Oh, gosh.
So pretty much my whole world just fell apart right there. And I went into a complete and utter downward spiral, dark night of the soul, totally lost. And I pretty much, without filing for bankruptcy, I was lucky enough I didn't file for bankruptcy, but I lost everything. My car got repossessed. I literally was selling my shoes to pay my rent. Luckily, I had 200 shoes because I can, it made for a lot of garage sales. I had a garage sale like every weekend. I would have a garage sale because that was the only way I was going to pay my rent. And there's nothing like going broke to get spiritual.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't know what to do, and I had been seeing a therapist, and he had gone to the Self-Realization Fellowship, SRF. And he had suggested that to me, so I signed up. They have this course that you can take through the mail for meditation, and then you can go. They have classes and things like that. I had just signed up for that, and the only friend that I had that kept me was this girl. Her name is JJ. She's still a really good friend of mine now. And she started dragging me to yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And I would ride my bike everywhere all around L.A. because I didn't have a car anymore.
Aww.
So I was like this weird, crazy bike cat lady.
Yeah.
At 20, I was, how old was I at that point? 29. And so I started doing yoga. And I started doing this thing in my house. And this is the important part of the story because the dates are really important. On August 1st, I got a phone call from Mark Vicente, who was one of the other filmmakers on the fleet, and he left me a message. Now, you know this being in the entertainment business. You don't call people back when you have something to – I'm sorry, my daughter's waving bye-bye to me. Forgive me for that. You know, you don't call people back when you don't have – my life is falling apart, and I don't have a job, and I'm selling my shoes. You don't do that. Because you're not cool at that point. So I never called Mark back. And I didn't have any friends, and I didn't have a television. So I would get up every morning, and I would start writing this list of what it was that I wanted in my life. And if anybody has seen What's a Bleep, there's those questions at the beginning, why do I keep recreating the same reality?
Mm-hmm.
How do I get out of where I'm at? All that stuff. That was all the stuff that I was started thinking about.
That's your list.
And so I wrote this list, and it took me a month of writing this list. And here's the four things that I wrote on the list. I wrote, I knew that I loved making movies, and I actually really missed that. And I said, I want to make a film that'll have an impact on me and humanity.
Hmm.
Number two, I want to get out of debt. Number three, I want a life partner who is going to be my equal.
Hmm.
And number four, I want to move out of Los Angeles. So on August 30th, I'm pedaling my bike down the road, and I get home, and I hear this message on my machine, and it's another girl that I hadn't spoke to in a long time calling me up to say, hey, I've got this movie, it's going to be in Puerto Vallarta for 4 months, and it's going to pay you this much money. It was exactly the amount of money that I was in debt.
Oh, gosh.
And it took me to Puerto Vallarta for 4 months. Now, it wasn't any movie with any redeeming qualities whatsoever. But it was still a movie, so I thought, well, wow, that's pretty amazing. Look at that, 3 out of 4. That's not bad. And then I remembered that Mark Vicente had called me on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, I got to call Mark back. So I call Mark back, and he's like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm going to go do this movie in Puerto Vallarta. And he's like, no, you're not. I'm coming to your house. Now, Mark Vicente and I had worked together a lot. He was one of those people who I hired as a DP.
Mm-hmm.
And we were kind of friendly, but he'd never been to my house. He shows up on my doorstep. And he says, I want you to read this script. And he starts telling me about this movie, which was totally different than The Bleep. It was a very different movie then.
Mm-hmm.
And I just looked at him and said,
that was Arndt's first vision.
That was the first script.
Yeah. Well,
and he said, I'm not making this movie. First of all, you can't afford me. Secondly, this is ridiculous. I don't even have to spell quantum physics, let alone think about it. I don't care about science. And he said, look, will you just read it? And I said, you know, it's fine. I didn't have a TV. I didn't have anything else to read. So I was like, well, I'll start reading the script. Excuse me. And I began to read this script, which was really more of an outline of a lot of the science.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that we're addicted to our emotions, that we create a reality. It was as if the universe was answering all the questions that I had just spent the month asking.
And let me just interject for the listeners that right now what we're talking about are the steps that led Betsy Chaffee into producing, co-directing, and writing What the Bleep Do We Know? Sorry, go ahead.
Right, that's okay. was it. I had to make this movie, come hell or high water. And Will called me up and we started talking, and he basically said, let's go make this movie. And when I got up to, he said, I want you to come to Washington because Will hates L.A. He doesn't hate L.A. He just doesn't, he doesn't like to go hang out down there.
Everybody I like hates L.A. So
you know,
he hates L.A. That's
you know, he just didn't want to be down there.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
he wanted to,
yeah.
He had a place in Washington because right. Both he and Mark at that point went to the Rompa School of Enlightenment. So Will had a place up here in Washington. Come to Washington. And I was like, I wasn't going to argue with him because I wanted to get out of L.A. anyway. So, I said, sure, let's do it up there. And I came up to Washington, and at that point in time, I was really just a hired gun. I was hired to produce this thing that they had given me. And I sat with Will, and I said, what are your goals for this movie? And he started to tell me that he wants to share this knowledge with humanity. He wants 100 million people to see this movie. And I said, well, no one's going to see this movie that you've written because it's boring and a piece of poo-poo. And Will, being Will, said, okay, well, what would you do? And that led to Mark, Will, and I really becoming collaborators, and we started all over and just started on the road that became The Bleep. And during that time, for me, I was the person on The Bleep that I was always saying, "What? I don't understand what this means, and how does this relate to me?" Because, and it was the same for Will and Mark in their own perspective, but for me, this is really important because this is life-altering, life-changing. That for me, this was a whole new way of looking at reality and the world than I had ever thought of before. And it's since that time, you know, I came to Washington and within two weeks met my husband. And we now have a two-year-old daughter. And I live up in Washington. And I just live in a much more empowered place.
It's just unbelievable.
So I was going to say, you know, what's amazing is that it's so important to me because why making The Bleep was so important to me was because I was having such an awakening that I wanted to share it because I know so many people that feel that they're stuck in that cycle and they don't know how to get out and they don't know how to recreate, to stop recreating the same realities, and they don't know how to empower themselves. I just feel like humanity's at that place where they just really need, you know, something. And I think that, you know, I look back at some of the stuff we said in The Bleep and I go, well, maybe that's not necessarily totally correct, or, you know, maybe that was our own, you know, because Will, Mark, and I just kind of made our own movie. We didn't have anybody saying you have to do this, but overall, I mean, ultimately, I really do believe, and I think the reason The Bleep is so successful, I've been getting a lot of calls lately from other people who are doing movies. Okay, so what did you do that made The Bleep successful? You know, can you please tell me what you did? And it's sort of like, no, I can't tell you what we did. And the reason is because I think that Will, Mark, and I were so passionate about experiencing what we were talking about, and we really truly believed it, and we do believe it, that there was such an intent that it there was no way it was going to be anything but successful.
I not only did I see the first film, but I read the book in detail. What in the Bleep? Is it called What in the Bleep? Do we know as well?
Uh-huh.
And I read that in detail and highly recommend it to the listeners because it gives you just a lot of background on all the individuals involved. But one of the things that I saw was the humanity of you and Will and Mark coming through, that this was not some formulaic, you know, picture, that it was something that you just sort of, we've heard the adage overused, you know, leap and the net will appear, but
mm-hmm.
that's what seems to have happened.
And it is what happened.
It's a miracle.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
What it is that we realized that what we were saying was so important that we needed to get out of the way of it and just allow it to be said. Mm-hmm. I'm reading this book right now called The Unlikely Prophet,
right.
Which was, have you heard of that book?
I have it.
Oh, I just heard my friend just gave it to me, and they talk about, there's this, in the beginning of the book, they talk about, he has this conversation with Jackson Pollock.
Why don't you get the author's name?
Oh, God, I don't remember the author's name.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, it's downstairs, otherwise I tell you.
Next week.
Yeah, the guy who was one of the writers on Superman and Batman.
Right.
And it's called The Unlikely Prophet. But Jackson Pollock talks about how he paints. And that he just allows it to happen.
That's right.
And that it happens the same way because he just allows it to happen. And that's, it was interesting because before, if you had, when I was in my prosperity picture days and you had told me that, I would have looked at you like you were an alien.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but really, we set an intent, which we focused on, and then we just, you know, people oftentimes will say, well, how did you survive with three filmmakers? You know, of course we had our battles and our moments, but really in the end, we would always ask the question, does this serve the movie?
Right.
And that's really the end of it. If it serves the movie, it stays. And it will tell you if it serves the movie. I mean, we were editing up to the very last moment because there were times when we'd watch it or, you know, we'd see something and we'd go, you know what? We like that because we think it's cool, but it doesn't serve the movie.
Yeah, and that's where the hard choices have to be made. I'm a playwright and researching my first screenplay. And look, you know, doing a workshop production of my last play and having to let go of whole scenes that I loved and was attached to emotionally because, like you said, they don't serve to further the story. And,
right.
And they're not wasted because, you know, you may use a bit of that in another piece that you write or
that moment
or
that
whatever.
That moment that you created in that scene helped you get to a moment that does serve the movie.
Right, or it creates backstory for the
right.
actors who are playing the parts in the other
right.
scenes. Right.
Right. And it's just...
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. It's just about, I think for me, the biggest lesson that I learned was that I don't have to force everything mass to mass. That's a very Rompha saying, actually, you know, mass to mass. It's sort of like pushing and prodding and forcing things to take shape.
Right.
But that if I step back and have an intent, then if I just allow the intent to take its life, take life into form, then it will come. And that when if I let go of the when, where, why, how, and what, that I'm really, that really actually my intent will come true in a way that is much more profound than I even expected it to be.
That's very, very helpful for everyone to hear that. Because I know, I can imagine that you had the same energy I had and sometimes still do have, which is just, I'm going to put 120% effort into this project and I can't let there be room for anything else to come in. And if I push my will like that so strongly, there may be something even more marvelous than I could ever conceive of. So you have to back off a little. Is that right?
Back off is a good way to explain it, absolutely. I think that when we become so rigid in how it has to look
mm-hmm.
and how it has to come, that we totally miss out. A really great example of this is, for me, was Rompha.
Tell our listeners who Rompha
is. Okay, Rompha is the best way for me to describe Rompha is it's a channeled entity. And I don't know anything else but that. It's a channeled entity channeled by a woman named Jay-Z Knight. And there's a lot of people have lots of opinions about Rompha and what it is and what it isn't and all that stuff. And none of that really matters to me because there was a time, I ended up going to the Rompha School of Enlightenment for a couple of years. I don't go now. I sort of gained what I wanted to gain from there and moving on to other things. But what was interesting was that there was a part of me in the past that would have looked at that and just thought it was just a joke. I said, please, I'm not listening to some channel dandy. That's a joke, and those people are stupid. Look at all those crazy cult members or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But what was interesting was that because I started this movie and I had such an intent that I really wanted this information to get out there, I listened to everybody, every kind of person that had something to say about it because I really wanted to know.
And he was one of the people you interviewed.
He was one of the people that we interviewed. And there were some really profound lessons for me there And I was interesting. I was at a studio recently, a big major studio, called me in and wanted to talk to me about some projects and things like that. And this person said to me, "My favorite person in the movie was that woman who had the English accent." And I was thinking to myself, "What movie? What woman who had the?" I said, "Oh, you mean Ramsa?" Mm-hmm. And she said, "Well, yeah." And I said, "Well, Ramsa's not a woman. Ramsa's a channeled entity, and it's a man." And she got infuriated. And I said, "Well, it's on the website. It's right there for everyone to know what Ramsa is." I can't believe you made me listen to that person. I said, "Well, A, I didn't make you listen to that person. And just 2 seconds ago, that person had some really important things to say to you."
Right.
"That you had a profound reaction to. But now because you don't like the packaging, you're going to throw it all away? Well, that's really sad." And how often in our lives do we do that? How often in our lives does some gem come to us, but because we don't like the packaging it came in, we won't buy it?
Well, and here's the other thing that I've had to come to terms with, because I interview a lot of people, some of whom are considered gurus, and is that I listen to the message.
Mm-hmm.
I listen to the message.
Yeah.
I try not to judge the human being.
Mm-hmm.
Because humans are complex entities in and of themselves. And I know from looking at myself, I have great intentions. I'm a wonderful person. And I also have a shadow side.
Right.
As a human. And so how dare I judge another human being who is putting out information that resonates as truth to me?
Right.
And that's the way I justify having people on my show that are controversial. You know, how dare I judge them?
Right.
If what they're saying relates to this topic of art and transformation, then that's good. You know, they're humans.
And you're an open person, but most people, unfortunately, in society, we've become so indoctrinated into the way things are supposed to be,
mm-hmm.
that we lose sight of the way things that could be.
It's fear.
I'm sorry?
It's fear.
Yeah.
That keeps us from opening our hearts and our minds, I think.
Right. That's true. And I try every day when I wake up now, I say to myself, you know, you're going to be open to the experience of today. And don't, you know, yes, you have things that you want to accomplish today. And you should accomplish those things. But don't be so rigid in how they get accomplished that you cannot stop for a moment and see the magic in front of you.
I love that. I think I've read that you said that. That's wonderful. I need to remember that. Don't be so rigid in the way I visualize things panning out today that I fail to be open to the magic.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that, yeah, I mean, I think I do it all the time. Like the other day, I wanted to clean my kitchen, and my daughter wanted to play, and I really wanted to get my kitchen cleaned. And finally, somewhere in the middle of cleaning the kitchen, I looked at myself and I said, you know what? This kitchen will get cleaned. My daughter will not be in this moment forever.
That's right.
So what's more important, a clean counter or having that moment with your child?
That's right. And if we can only remember that, I have to remind myself of that. And you have a 2-year-old, and those moments just fly by.
Yeah.
If you've just joined us on Conscious Creating with Sarah Robinson, I'm talking with Betsy Chaffee, co-director, writer, and producer of the 2004 film What the Bleep Do We Know, and its newly released sequel, Down the Rabbit Hole. Well, we have just hit on all these terrific topics, but I really want to make sure that we get to what you're doing next. And you've done these great films, made some wonderful connections. Your life has completely transformed through motherhood and married life. Are you still working?
I am kind of still working. I'm taking a lot more time to spend with my daughter and to spend with my family. But I started a company recently called Elora Media, which is named after my daughter, Elora Thea is her name, but we call it Elora Media. And Elora Media, I've looked around as I traveled around the world opening the Bleep and doing talks about the Bleep. I think because I was the woman in the group and because I was the new mom, I gave birth to my daughter right as the What the Bleep is opening in theaters. And literally would do openings with a little one-month-old, like, in a papoose on my chest, you know?
It's metaphoric, isn't it?
It's true. I had two babies in 2004. Mm-hmm. And so many people would come to me and say, well, what are you doing for children? What's out there for children? What are you going to create for kids? So I began Allure Media as a medium for bringing great books, videos, and... Sorry about that. My other line is ringing. We'll just give it a second. Bringing great books, music, and CDs to... And so I start in August. We're launching the website, which is Allura, E-L-O-R-A, media.com. And we'll have, I'm publishing three books on my own, which are really wonderful. And they're not I'm not writing them, but I've got a wonderful writer who's writing them. And then
I'm bringing on that writer.
His name is Gary Craig. And these are the first books that he's publishing. He's recently had this, he's on his second child now, and he's written one book called Where Does the Sun Go, which is a very sweet story about the sun and about nature. And he's also written a book called You Can Be Anything, which is sort of a sweet poem about empowerment. And then the third is a coloring book, activity book, for children with positive affirmations. And then I'm also working on some other products, which I can't mention yet, but there'll be some music CDs, and there'll be some CDs that help children understand the power of intent and understand the world around them and how, you know, magical they are. And that's really the focus of it. Because I think, you know, children, I realize there's a lot of companies now coming out with spiritual movies for adults, and I think that's really great, and I think it's really important. But I've realized that the future of humanity is in our children.
And you're growing where you're planted today. You are a mom. I think I told you before we went online that I teach parenting classes right now, and I do it when I have the time. But for underprivileged parents in particular. But I won't be valid or have any validity or credibility 10 years from now doing that, but I can do it now.
Right.
And you can really do this now because you're reading children's books and listening to videos. That's wonderful.
And I've noticed that as far as videos go, there aren't any videos that really take the ideas of spirituality and empowerment and bring them to kids, mostly because most parents who are, quote, spiritual, you know, don't want their kids to watch videos. But, you know, I love sitting down with Ella and watching a video. I mean, Ella doesn't sit in front of a TV without me, but we sit together and, you know, it's an interaction. Mm-hmm. There's something we can do together. Mm-hmm. So the idea partially is that if you look at Baby Einstein, I think there's lots of videos that really teach children how to read and write and know their colors. But there isn't anything out there that reminds a child of the magical self that they are. And so that's our intent with Allura Media. And so we've got the three books coming out. I've got about five other books that will be on the site and some other music. Some really great – I've had the opportunity to find out in the world some really gems that are really beautiful that people have created that no one's seeing right now because, you know, I'm blessed right now in that I have access to distribution. Mm-hmm. And I have access to an audience. And so there's some great, I mean, anybody who has a really great children's project that they've created, you know, they can email me at Allure Media and I'll check it out because I think there's some beautiful, wonderful books that have been written and there's some beautiful songs that have been written. And I think that, you know, I want to become the Baby Einstein of the spiritual side of that.
Well, I personally know an author. I can put you in touch with. So we'll
right. I mean, I think it's time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's time. I think, you know, I go to a lot of spiritual bookstores because I do a lot of talks at them. And, you know, the children's section is way in the back and it's kind of hidden.
Right.
And I think that we should change that. I think it's time for children to have access to all these wonderful books and all these wonderful concepts because the truth is they know them. And if I'm hopeful for me as a mother that I can just keep Allura Thea genuine in that remembrance And whatever I can do to support her in that is what I want to do. I've noticed that one of the things that we're working on is that I don't want them to be too, sometimes they get too metaphysical or they try too hard to teach.
You're right.
To teach right and wrong. Mm-hmm. So I'm really focused on stories where there are more fables or there are more ways in which the child learns through the experience, not because it says in the book, this is right and
right.
this is wrong. Or,
but that have more of a mythic quality.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm afraid we've come to the end of this wonderful conversation. I could go on for another hour with you.
Well, thank you. There's one other thing I just want to add before I forget. We're having an event in Los Angeles. It's called Bleep Fest, and the soundtrack and the box, the multi-disc set of Down the Rabbit Hole is going to be available in August, and everybody can go to whatthebleep.com and find out more about that.
That's right.
That's my shameless plug.
No, I was going to give it to you anyway.
Oh,
Betsy Chaffee, thank you for talking with me tonight.
Thank you very much.
Really,
it's been a pleasure.
Conversation. I hope we'll have a chance to continue this dialogue in the future.
Thank you.
I encourage our listeners to learn more about Betsy's work and her latest project, Down the Rabbit Hole, by visiting her Bleeping website at www.whatthebleep.com. Thank you for joining us on Conscious Creating this and every Thursday evening. We hope you'll visit our website at www.consciouscreating.net to learn more about the show, my art and thinking, and to give us your thoughts on what you heard tonight. This is your host, Sarah Robinson, wishing you a fruitful week of conscious creating.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.